the public safety finance meeting will come to order.
We were waiting for Representative Walker to begin and give some introductory comments about the working group that was studying the Ombudsman for Corrections, but apparently she's been held up for some reason. So what we'll do then is have Commissioner Corbell from the Department of Human Rights, if you could maybe talk a little bit about, give some introductory comments and what the working group actually did. I see you have a PowerPoint presentation. Remember that for those of you who don't remember, you should have a copy of the report to the legislature, but this was a bill from Representative Neva Walker that was asking the Minnesota Department of Human Rights and the working group to look at the issue of the Ombudsman for Corrections that was phased out during the budget crisis of 2003, to really ask the question about whether we should reinstate the Ombudsman for Corrections or have it in a different form, and also to look at issues regarding our inmates in our county jails. So it was sort of a big charge that we asked you to do, and looking forward to hearing your comments today. So, Commissioner Corbell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Paymar and committee members. Good morning. My name is Delma Corbell, and I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And at the end of the last legislative session, I was asked to serve as a convener of the working group to study the issues surrounding the Ombudsman for Correction, as Representative Paymar has just given you a brief overview. I was hoping that Representative Walker could be here this morning to sort of set the stage for the working group report, because it really has been Representative Walker who has championed the work of the working group, and I just think it would be, if you haven't heard from her, which I'm sure most of you probably have, she has just a lot of passion around this issue. But the reason she, and I won't use the word duped me into doing the convener job, because I would never use that word to describe that behavior, but when we were talking about the Corrections Ombudsman in the last legislative session, there were lots of questions that kept coming up, primarily around the fact that there were service organizations and advocacy organizations and legislators, particularly Representative Walker, who seemed to continuously receive complaints and inquiries from inmates both in the prison, the state prison system, and in the county jails, and their families. And Representative Walker had become, since the Ombudsman's Office was phased out in 2003, the de facto Ombudsman for the prison system and also for the county jails. So back at the end of the legislative session, there was a charge through the Public Safety Omnibus Finance Bill to create this working group to do several things. Primarily, it was to study how we look at, as a state and as a county system, look at complaints, assaults, and deaths in the jails, workhouses, and prisons. Also to make recommendations back to the legislature in this session for how to address the complaints, assaults, and deaths. If we found that the policies and procedures that are currently in place were not effective, we were also to make a recommendation, as Representative Paymar said, on the need to reappoint the Ombudsman for Corrections, and then to make this report back to the legislature this session. One of the things I think it's important to point out is that beginning on page two double I's of the report document, which you all should have, there were individuals that the legislation called out who should participate in this working group to give us a balanced overview of the stakeholders in this project. And beginning on page II of the report, you will notice that there are a list of individuals and organizations. And to really get a representative sample of the stakeholders who had issues around the Ombudsman for Corrections, we actually did something a little more more broadly than what the legislation called for, and sent out a call to groups who had a stake in this issue to invite them to also participate in the working group. So you will see that there were corrections practitioners from both DOC and the county jails. There were there's a representative from the Sheriff's Association, from the Association of the Community Corrections at Counties. There were representatives on the working group for the Senator Linda Higgins' office, also from Representative Paymore's office, and Senator and Representative Walker, I just promoted you, Representative Walker was at the meeting. So she was in the room with us and providing that support and sort of the information that underpinned her request. I also want to talk about the working group process because I don't want to give the impression that this was this became by this report by accident, because that's just not how it happened. We spent over 2,000 hours from August to January with about 25 people on this working group, looking at thousands of pages of documents. A bibliography is in the report document. We conducted interviews over the phone, in person. We created a website specifically for information related to this working group so that the working group members would always have access to that information, and also there was information that the public could also go and access when they thought it was they needed to get that. We also invited in past corrections ombudsmen to hear from them about the processes that they use and their experience in the job. We also, as I mentioned, the thousands of pages of documents that we looked at. The department, at our expense, because I'm sure you recall that there was not a any funding dedicated to the working group study, but at the department's expense, we actually hired two part-time research interns to really delve into pulling this information together, going to the through the historical records and calling other states and looking at ombudsman programs from other states. So if there is anything said this morning that this was sort of an accidental path to the recommendations, that's just, I would just like to correct that if I could. But so here, the slide that you're looking at just indicates some of the information that was reviewed in preparation of the report. In terms of information from the public, when we had a report drafted, we had a public hearing here in the state office building on January 17th, and we took testimony from the public. We also provided some additional time to receive written comments from individuals who weren't able to make it to that public hearing on January 17th. And when I say public hearing, we actually did work through Senator Higgins' office to make sure that proper notices were given through all of the publications that require the notice of a hearing like this, so that we had input and involvement from individuals from around the state. And there are summaries of the verbal comments and some of the written comments that we got from inmates that are part of the report that you have. And we also received, up through January 25th, comments on organizations' letterhead that we scanned and made part of the working group report, and you will see those towards the end of the document that you have. In over about 5 months of this, there were some key things that we learned that really pointed us to the recommendations that we'll talk about here in a bit. But some of the things that came out over and over again through this process is that where there are policies at the Minnesota Department of Corrections to deal with inmate complaints, grievances, assaults, and deaths, those policies don't transcend into the county jails. And it was very clear that of the 87 counties in Minnesota, that the policies may be there, but the actual methodologies, the persons assigned to, the individuals responsible for doing work similar to what the Ombudsman of Corrections may have performed, it's very different from county to county, depending on the resources that the counties have. Of course, the metropolitan counties seem to do a better job with implementing the policies that they have developed. And I'll point out one specific thing that we learned, in that most of the grievance procedures, well, all of them have to have an appeal process, but in some of the smaller counties, the county sheriff is actually in the second step of that appeal process, and that may give rise to a situation that inmates and their families may view as not being fair. But that is not something that I think we can correct overnight, because it really is indicative of the environment and what resources are available in those counties. One of the other things that we learned is that while Minnesota DOC has policies in place, and they appear to be good policies on the face of those policies, and they all are, they follow the best practice standards of the American Corrections Association, and that was indicated to us over and over again, that they use their policies are created using the standard, using the format that the ACA uses across the country. One of the things that we found also during the process is that the common denominator between prisons and jails in the state of Minnesota is a unit in Minnesota DOC called the Facilities and Inspection Unit. And that is the unit inside DOC that actually certifies and licenses all of the corrections facilities, state and county facilities in the state. And it seems to the working group that if there is a unit in DOC that's responsible for certifying the prisons and the jails, so that would seem to be the nexus where standard procedures, policies, etc. should come from, and that group then could provide the oversight for them. One of the other learnings from the working group process is that there are requests from the public that come in often for information on race and disability data as it relates to grievances and complaints filed by inmates in the state prisons and also those incarcerated in the county facilities. And through our data requests from both the counties and from the state, I used these words, and I was very cautious to use these words that you see in the slide, that the information was often not available in the way it was requested from DOC, and rarely, very rarely available from the county jails. And in learning, in going through this, we learned from the county jails that a lot of the data that is requested from the public is just not tracked. And so there's not anything there to respond to a public request for data, because they just don't have the wherewithal to collect and track the data. One of the things we learned is that the county jails specifically believe that they're already regulated enough, and that any additional regulation to them without sufficient resources to back that up would be almost impossible for them to comply with. And lastly, we thought as a working group that if the Ombudsman for Corrections was not recreated, if there is a basically equivalent service or process that is created to take the place of it, that it must embody the values that are described on page 16 of this report. And if you will just turn with me quickly to that report, the values and characteristics are at the bottom of the page, and there are, you know, a 15 of them, but the Ombudsman Working Group felt that there was ample discussion, more than enough discussion, to indicate the fact that there needed to be some sort of bridge between the correction system and the public as a conduit for information, as a way to work with inmates and respond to requests from inmates and their families. So from all of these documents, all of the data requests, all of the conversations that we have, again, as I mentioned, over 2,000 hours, we have some recommendations to bring to the committee. The recommendations begin on page 17 of the report. The first recommendation was that somehow the data collection through the correction system be standardized. Standard reporting system, and also on a standard criteria. One of the things we learned in bringing this recommendation forward is that even if you try to get data and information from the jails and from the state prisons, it's difficult to do because they even, the data that they do collect, they do it on a different fiscal year basis. And so that would cause some problems in terms of comparing apples to apples. And we felt strongly that the standard collection period, standard categories, standard criteria should be used throughout the jails and the prisons, the state prisons, and that the facilities and inspection unit could be the unit inside DOC who would provide the oversight for that. And that's the data that the public requests, and this is the way that it could be made available to them. There was a recommendation that came to the working group that when we talk about the standard categories and standard criteria of data, recommendation number two, that we collect and report on the race and disability data, because by and large, over and over again, this seems to be the category, the protected class classification, where people have the most questions. And so if we could create a way for that race and disability data to be collected and tracked and available to the public, the working group thought that would be one way to improve circumstances. Again, going back to my comment about the level of resources needed to create tracking and monitoring systems and to be able to provide that to the public is included in recommendation three, and that was to bring to the committee that if we're going to do something, that we need adequate funding to be able to support the requests in one and the recommendations in one and two above. Another recommendation is that there needs to be education and outreach to all of the community resources that provide services to inmates, their families, from DOC and the county jails. And DOC has indicated that they, in addition to the orientation they provide up at the St. Cloud facility, that they could probably enhance the work that they're doing in that area. Also, to provide an orientation to certain legislators who may have constituencies that would rely on the legislator for information to come from the prison system and the jails, that DOC and the county jails have policies and procedures that even through the working group process we learned that not everybody knows about. And it would be helpful if there was some formalized way to be able to get information out to individuals who are providing services or who are resources to individuals in the county system and also in the state system. It was felt by the working group that there were categories of data in the data request that we were successful in obtaining, looking at the recommendation here, conducting an independent study, that there were some categories, particularly around medical discrimination, housing, and religion, where there seemed to be a larger number of grievances and complaints coming in those categories. And because we did not have enough time as a working group to really look at those issues as deeply as we would have liked, that there should be some additional work done to look at those categories of complaints to find out if there are some systemic issues or questions that need to be asked around those areas. On the bottom of page 18, you'll note that there are some suggestions. We're not calling them recommendations. These were things that came up during the discussions at the working group, but the working group did not have enough time to reach consensus on these items. And that is, the first one is creating a service similar to the Corrections Ombudsman for recently released offenders to attempt to mitigate or ameliorate the recidivism, because some of the service and advocacy organizations believe that there was a great need by the DOC to provide a service to those individuals to prevent them coming back into the system. There's a recommendation at the bottom of page 18 regarding creating the Office of the Ombudsman and giving it priority to deal with juvenile issues. There were existing current ombudsmen on the working group, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and the Ombudsman for Crime Victims. And we had conversations about the dearth of resources available to individuals in juvenile facilities and the need for services for juveniles, but also the need in terms of mental health services for juveniles and for adults in the prison system. And while we believe was outside the mandate of the working group and really needed much more time to discuss and debate, we did think it was important to bring this forward to the committee so that you're aware that there's a great need for services there. Just very briefly, the recommendations that the working group is bringing forward. And since Representative Walker is here, I would just like to take a minute before we take questions or comments from the committee, if we could, Representative Tamar, to have her give that setup.
Commissioner, thank you very much for your testimony and also for convening the working group. I know it was quite a task, and you did a great job. I appreciate it. Representative Walker, welcome to the committee. We started without you, but
yes.
We were hoping that you would give the opening comments, but here's your chance.
Mr. Chair, I, by nature, I do run a little late, but the traffic, I'm used to getting here at 9. I don't know how you guys get here at 8 o'clock, especially if you're coming from the west side of the Mississippi.
Mr. Chairman, some of us have trouble doing
that. Thank you, Representative Cole. A few different things. I really want to thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for helping me figure out a way to look at this issue further. As you know, I was quite frustrated with how do we move forward, knowing that it'd be difficult to find the resources to reestablish an office and not knowing if that was the best way to do it independently. Commissioner Corbell and her staff were fabulous in this process. And when we went into the first meeting, how do you come to a consensus when you know individuals are on one side and the other side? And where's the middle ground? And I think that it was important for me to be there because I needed to hear what corrections and especially the jails were feeling. The things to highlight just briefly, though, the public hearing meeting that the commissioner talked about, I think it's important to know it was one of the coldest days that we had this winter. And I was shocked. To the point where I was like, well, maybe we shouldn't have this because who's going to come? Because I wouldn't come. And this is my issue. It took me a hard time to get there, and people really showed up. And it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. There were individuals that were giving testimony that blew my mind on the impact that, from lawyers who are working with individuals, especially around mental health issues, that are having difficulties in the prison system. One of the other things that really struck me through this process was DOC has this fabulous system of 22 different categories, where if an inmate has a complaint, they have a way to record it under 22 different categories. However, not one of those 22 categories was discrimination. And I thought to myself, how ironic, because many of the letters that I received, whether it is real or perceived, individuals are feeling like they have been discriminated. And when you have a system where over the majority of the staff are Caucasian, and depending on the census numbers at the time, at least half of it being people of color, whether, again, it's perceived or it's biased or however you look at it, there is going to be a level of where individuals think that they're being discriminated on one point or another. If an inmate thinks that they're being discriminated by staff, it's actually under the category of staff, not looking at further what was the inmate having concerns with. The other thing to know, that you may hear concerns about timing. I tried to let folks know there wasn't enough time, but this is what we usually do. We usually give an issue, 5-6 months and come back quickly to the legislature with recommendations. And it's just a process that we have. There are some opportunities, knowing that this is not a funding year, and we do have some budget difficulties of looking further in some ad hoc groups and being able to come back in some recommendations for next year. I do think that this is something that this body and this committee should not lose while I may be retiring. That just has nothing to do with what we should be doing policy-wise. I just received a letter this week, Mr. Chair, from an inmate, and again, the difficulties that individuals are having. If you end up in a unit where there might have been an episode of violence, it's most likely that the unit will be closed down and segregated, which is fine because the DOC needs to make sure that they get a hold of inmates and nothing else is going to happen. One of the last things that he said to me was, I want you to know that I believe that more violence is going to occur because of the frustration that individuals are having. And that concerns me greatly. Not only for the safety of our individuals that are protecting the inmates, but the safety of the inmates too. I don't want individuals doing unnecessary harm to one another, not only, you know, with possibility of causing great harm or taking a life, but then also staying in there longer than they need to be staying in there just because they didn't feel that they had any other means to get their issues heard. Just lastly, again, I just want to thank everyone. We do have some pieces that are missing, and there are quite a bit, actually, things that DOC is doing along with the jails. But the bottom line is, we heard it over and over, no matter which community member we were talking to in what section of the community we were talking to, whether it was someone of color or mental health or individuals that have family members there, that there does seem to be a bias out there, whether it's real or perceived. That's just the reality of the individuals that have loved ones that are incarcerated. So I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, again for your time.
Thank you, Representative Walker. We'll take questions now. I just have one to start, and then Representative Smith go next. I don't know if there's anyone from DOC here, but did the Department of Corrections in the working group discuss the sort of a striking number, only 3% of the staff at the Department of Corrections, if I read this right, is a person of color. Is that correct? And 42% of the inmate population in the department, in our prisons, are people of color. And did they talk about trying to recruit more people of color for staff positions as guards, etc.?
Mr. Chair and committee members, those are the numbers, and we actually received those numbers from the Department of Corrections relative to the staff, and we had a combination of numbers from the DOC numbers and also from the Council on Crime and Justice regarding the population of inmates of color in the prison system. We did not talk about the methods for recruiting staff of color in DOC, and I think that's a question that we could probably ask them.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one of the things that from just individuals that I've talked to over the years, and you know, whenever I get an employment thing, I shoot it off to communities. But it comes down to, you know, DOC is supposed to be a partner. And that perception of being open and friendly always isn't there with communities of color. And so it's something that DOC is going to have to work on really hard, especially just working with our councils of color, just to reestablish a good public relationship with the public so you do have individuals of color that are willing to apply.
Representative Cole, this point.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, can you comment at all? If maybe you don't know, but how do those numbers compare to other law enforcement professions, either police officers or DPS, state troopers? Is that consistent with what we're seeing in other law enforcement professionals, or is it lower? Is it, help me out a little.
You know, we did not study the numbers across the range of the industry. But I would expect, just in the kind of work that I do, I would expect that those numbers are pretty standard across the industry.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the reason for raising that question is that, well, I agree, I'd like to see, DOC do more to try to bring in more people of color. Let's be careful not to paint this as just a DOC issue if it's broader than that. I mean, it sounds like, we have, and again, I don't have the numbers, but I mean, it sounds like the percentages at DOC are not necessarily out of the range of normal for the rest of law enforcement, and maybe there's a broader issue in terms of how we recruit and attract more individuals of qualified individuals of color across the board, not just at DOC.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to note that it's true rather than opposed, but one of the differences, State Patrol actually has done different recruiting methods over the years for going into the schools or going into the community colleges along with certain divisions of our law enforcement. And so there has been a little bit more effort by some of the other sectors. And so, you know, I think it'd be nice just to go into our community colleges more. I think, if I'm not mistaken, and DLC can correct me or not, I know there has been, but it just hasn't. They could do more.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I want to get to the crux of what I think we're talking about, and that's the bringing back the Office of the Ombudsman for Corrections. Now, I don't know your position, and you can feel free to state it whether you advocate for that or not, but I do note that the charge for the working group was, among other things, to make a recommendation on the need to reappoint a corrections ombudsman. On page 18 of the report, there is no recommendation to do that. There is a suggestion that this is an issue to be considered by the legislature, but in fact it says the working group did not achieve consensus on the very issue of reappointing a corrections ombudsman. Isn't that correct?
Representative
Commissioner,
for committee members, we did talk about this issue in detail, and I can tell you that the individuals who were on the working group from DOC, while they would not categorically state that they supported the recreation of the office, they did say that they were, and I'm going to use the word neutral, because they indicated that if it was the legislature's desire to recreate this office, that DOC would not disagree with that, and they would support the office. But to get the group to the point where we could put on a piece of paper that we were bringing forward a recommendation that said, yes, recreate the office, we could not get there. The DOC is very adamant that they have created enough programs, enough policies, enough procedures that there isn't a need for a corrections ombudsman anymore. But for every person in DOC who would say that, there are people from the community, NAACP, Council of Colors, Legal Aid for Minnesota Prisoners, the Diversity Division of the State Bar, they will tell you that there is a need for an ombudsman service, because that the connection between the public and DOC is just a very difficult one.
Representative Smith.
Commissioner, the report, isn't it true that the report is not recommending reappointment of an ombudsman? There is no recommendation to do that. It is listed as an item for our consideration. Isn't that correct?
Commissioner Corbell.
Representative Tamar, Representative Smith, and committee members, there is a recommendation on page 18 that says that the working group agreed that we should reappoint a corrections ombudsman, and if not, to recreate an equivalent service with the values that I indicated that were on page 16.
Representative Smith.
Well, I'm trying to get at this word recommendation. What you just said about if we don't reappoint an ombudsman, that we have, that there's a recommendation for a similar service. But my copy of the report says that it's not a recommendation either. That's an issue for us to consider. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you would take out DLC and the jail representatives on the working group, you would have a consensus from the other individuals, whether they were lawyers, members of the ombudsman, myself, anyone else in the working group, you would have a consensus for the recommendation. But because we could not get consensus from the jails and DOC, you do not have a firm recommendation.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, I think that conflicts a bit with a letter in the packet that is signed by the Executive Director of the Sheriff's Association, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, that would, in the third paragraph down, conflicts a little bit with what you just said. The comments, the recommendations to expand recently released offenders, expanding the ombudsman program, were nothing more than a mere passing comment or desire by select individuals and did not result in any research, study, or constructive debate among working group members.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Distance. While I'm biased, you can, there are other individuals from the working group that are here that can testify that's not true. That is something that we spent a lot of time, and the commissioner can state that also. That statement is false.
Representative Biskin. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to Representative Smith's questions or comments, historically, DOC has always been neutral. And when we went through the various ombudsmen uniting separately as ombudsmen rather than with an agency, it was always emphasized that the ombudsman is supposed to be separate, a separate voice, and not part of the agency that they are ombudsmen with the constituents. And therefore, it's good when an agency is neutral, I would think, and cooperative. And the time period when Department of Corrections has been without, or when there's not been an ombudsman for the people that are incarcerated, Department of Corrections has continued the process that they had before. But it's, I think from historically, my knowledge from the past has been that people don't understand that process as well as they would an ombudsman that they could go to without knowledge of the department.
I might add that I don't see anyone from the department here. Is this someone?
Yes.
Oh, there is. Oh, okay. That I don't know if you. I'm sorry. I don't know if you wanna. We'll have a little bit of time here for some additional testimony before we hear Representative Simon's bill, but I know that Deputy Commissioner Benson said when we were hearing this bill last year that if you are going to create it, make sure that it's adequately staffed or recreate it. He didn't think it was effective at the point where we sort of well we essentially cut all the staff. I think there were one or two people and they really couldn't function well. So, are there any other questions of the Commissioner, Representative Walker, at this point? And then we'll hear from some other working group members who might want to provide some testimony. Okay. Representative Walker, if you want to stay, maybe. And is there anybody in the audience who would like to... let's see if the working group members... Are there any working group members here that would like to testify? Please come forward.
Chairman, my name is Lynn Dingle. I'm the current warden of the Stillwater Correctional Facility, and I was a working member, so members of the committee. If I could go back to some questions earlier about the recruitment process, we do recruit at local community colleges and some of the business colleges that have corrections programs now. We recruit in minority neighborhoods. We have a centralized office that has a recruiting component in it, and each facility has members and a committee for recruitment. So to answer that question, yes, we could do better. We try. Regarding the recommendation or the neutral position of the Department of Corrections, that is correct. We worked well with the ombudsman when we've had them in the past, and we will continue to do so. We do, however, believe that we've instituted many systems and allow offenders access to the media, to attorneys, to They have access to phones. I think we have, you know, put in place many things that we didn't have in place back in the early 70s when the Ombudsman was first created. But again, we will work well with them. We always have. And if this committee decides to reinstitute it, we would continue to do that. I agree with Deputy Commissioner Jensen's position that if we do it, we should do it well. One or two people in an office is not enough to be effective. We've got 10 correctional facilities that are state-run, and then all the jails and county divisions.
Thank you, Warden Dingell. Any questions? Representative Murphy.
One question, Warden Dingell, about the recruitment that you do. And when you get someone to come, then how long do they stay? Or do they get hired away by
Warden Dingell?
County.
Chairman Tamer, Representative Murphy, members of the committee. We try to retain everyone we can. When we lose many of our minority members, it's to promotions or transfers within the department, which we don't see as necessarily a bad thing.
Any other questions? Lily.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question for the Warden Lee. We had Commissioner Fabian here a while back, and this isn't related to this, but I wonder if you could comment quickly on the tunnel and what happened there, because Commissioner Fabian couldn't say anything at that point, but some time has passed. Are they to Hudson yet?
Warden Day.
No, they are not to Hudson yet. Actually, that is still under a criminal investigation because of potential charges for escape, attempted escape from custody. So at this point, I really can't comment. I've not seen the investigation as it's not complete. I can assure you that they're not halfway to Hudson.
Thank you.
Okay, anyone else from the working group? Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Roberta Olpine, the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and I was an active member of the working group. I want to make a comment quickly about the DOC and corrections and then an ombudsman role, in the sense that I also sit on the DOC's Mental Health Advisory Committee, and I do have to tell you, I think we have a very good Department of Corrections that is very responsive to people's needs, and I'm not as familiar with the jails. We have gotten calls as they relate to the disabilities since the demise of the Office of Ombudsman for Corrections, and of course we have no authority. We have a couple linkages within the department where we might refer a call. Having said that, though, even though I think we do have a good system, good systems are run by human beings. Human beings, both on the inmate side and the staff side, come with their own personalities, their own issues, their own perceptions. Even in the sheriff's letter, I know what I said about juvenile and mental health. I know what some others said about it. I respect the Sheriff's Association. I don't know how they heard that, what they heard, or how they filtered it. I respect that their opinion may be different than mine. The fact is, though, that is in fact how all interaction occurs, is that I know what I said, I know what I meant when I said it. I don't know what the other person hears. I don't know how they interpret what I say. And ombudsmen are typically not necessarily a tool to clean up bad government. They are a tool to keep good government on an even keel and to prevent deterioration. I think that we see that facilities that are under great duress, where there's a federal monitor comes in, or a state auditor, or a licensing, they can clean up things pretty fast. But without what's called a constant dynamic tension, in other words, some of us behave because we know there are highway patrol out there. not because we're inherently bad and we speed all the time, but we're more likely not to speed when we don't know when there's going to be a trooper. That's called the dynamic tension that helps to keep it in line. Doesn't mean one's good, one's bad. It just means that we do better when we know someone's watching over us. So I think that, you know, whether or not at this point in time we can afford the tool of good government, I do think is the legislative call. I do think it serves as a pressure valve. You know, no matter how much we try and how much the good policy is, if I'm on the other side of the issue and there's just two sides and one has more power than the other, I'm going to perceive it to be unfair and unbalanced. And if it's unfair, if it's perceived to be unfair and unbalanced, even if it is not, that affects people's behaviors, attitudes, and can create an environment that may or may not be as safe as if they feel that they were listened to in a neutral way. However, the point I really want to make, and one of my passions for my involvement there, and I agree different working group members don't necessarily agree with this, but I've struggled for at least 10 years with this concept that we have juvenile facilities licensed by corrections and by DHS, and yet I will tell you that even the delinquency behavior, except as we move to the real extreme end, is usually a symptom of something the child's trying to tell us. I'm not saying it's a symptom of mental illness, necessarily, but it's a symptom. And our law is very clear, it's supposed to be the best interest standard. But when there is an issue of mental health or treatment or appropriate best interest, there is no one that's authorized other than the licensing division, and they look simply at the rules, minimum rules and standard. Did they have policy procedures? There's no one to sort of argue or advocate for using knowledge of systems and resources for children housed in facilities licensed by DOC. And I will tell you, many of our clients who are never adjudicated as delinquent, in fact, receiving children's mental health services, are placed in DOC licensed facilities. And then if they don't get the mental health treatment they need, then there really isn't anyone with legal authority. Many facilities will at least take a phone call from us or don't keep us out, but when something happens, and it's not just the mental health and developmental disabilities, it's families of color, too.
Ms. Opheim, a quick question for either you or Representative Walker. You know, on the bottom of page 18, where it does say, if the legislature does recreate the office of Ombudsman for Correction, it should grant authority to the two remaining offices, and one is yours, but it specifically deals with juveniles, which you've just addressed, but why wouldn't the recommendation have been broader than that? I mean, I met with you a while back when the office was eliminated, and at that point I think we discussed the possibilities of, if we were to recreate it, to establish it within the Ombudsman of Mental Health, and that way that it would be shared expenses and we wouldn't have to create a whole new bureaucracy. Was that discussed at all, coupled with the fact that so many inmates in the adult institutions have mental health problems?
Chairman, members of the committee, it wasn't discussed extensively in terms of its broadness, as broad as you just represented. And frankly, I'm not sure that it, you know, there's always a balance between seeming that you're trying to ask for more powers and duties, which some days I feel like I'm drowning in the powers and duties right now. We did discuss, and we did hear people comment that of the problems that were on the table, the one that the jails struggled with the most were mental health issues. And people said, if we were to get any help, we'd like some help with mental health issues. The conversation that you and I had and that we've had in the past is, there have been various studies along the way that said you could either merge Ombudsman into a single classical, although I feel that may be disingenuous to the various communities of color, the grassroots organizations that helped to create them, or you could co-locate them and give them their own separate statutory authorities, Or you could create a hybrid where, you know, I think it would be important for the inmates not to perceive that they have to call the ombudsman for mental health. Mm-hmm. And so even if it were within my office, you'd create the kind of wall that, with cross-consultation. But it wasn't discussed extensively because I think it was true, there wasn't a clear consensus, or there were, better yet, there were strong feelings on both sides that made it sometimes more difficult to discuss that.
Thank you, Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
I think your point is, there were emails to the commissioner and some of the dialogue that happened in the working group of individuals that had a special interest in juveniles and mental health. And so that came up here and there, trying to figure out, not that we don't recognize the mental health issues that adult inmates have, it's just what are we going to do really about the juveniles when we have an opportunity to switch some of the behavior at an earlier age.
Okay, let's hear from some other members of the working group. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Lester Collins. I am the Executive Director of the State Council on Black Minnesotans. And I've been around a minute, about 20 years at this particular point or more. And I can honestly say, number one, that the committee was a hard-working group. At times could be controversial in nature, but I think that there was no doubt that there was a pretty good effort at trying to work towards some kind of consensus. I think that the commissioner, I think, did an excellent job of remaining the facilitator, if you will, although there was a consultant that helped in that process. I don't think that there's any doubt, at least in my mind, and I do have a staff person that is with me here today. Next to out-of-home placement-related kinds of issues, which I'm not sure that a day, certainly not two, go by that some member from the community, organization, someone, you know, is approaching the Council on Black Minnesotans in terms of their children, loss of children, some grandparent, etc. And the very next call, if it isn't, you know, even more so than out-of-home placement, would be those of inmates, their families, either confused, concerned, feeling like they have not been heard. I can tell you honestly, one of the things that I did come to appreciate, that there is no doubt that there are systems, that there are processes, you might say, that are in place. And I think that there are more than fair efforts, I think, at trying to address what I might call the absence of an ombudsman person. In many respects, I think, you know, goodness, I mean, in a strange way, it's almost like, you know, do you really think that, you know, the Department of Corrections, any amendments or, you know, to actually totally endorse the whole idea of an ombudsman person in some respects, I mean, there's functions, duties, people who have responsibilities to date, who carry on or have responsibilities similar to what an ombudsman person's responsibilities would be, I would say similar. There is no doubt, I think, as has been characterized, that apart from, say, the department itself, there was very little doubt that the great majority of other individuals knew on a first-hand basis. We're talking about probation officers, we're talking about family members, community people, who have very good relations, by the way, with the Department of Corrections. I can tell you that there was no doubt in my mind that an ombudsman person, and I'm not even going to say a similar function, because I still, to this day, after 20 years, there is no doubt that the quality of life, not only within, you know, those facilities, but the re-entry and the life outside of leaving that institution would be enhanced, that Minnesota would be a better place, that the working ability, the mental ability, the capability of our inmates would be enhanced therefore the state would be enhanced. I think that every dime that could be spent on this end and in this way, particularly dealing with transparency, access, and those kinds of things, would be well spent. And there was very little doubt in my mind, and particularly individuals who could not be a part of this working group, and not because they weren't invited or that there weren't efforts to hear their voices, but there's very little doubt in my mind that so many individuals who look like me that are now incarcerated and in many respects have no voice or don't know how to exercise that voice effectively, that the office of an ombudsperson is very much needed. And to me, there's no doubt that it needs to be adequately staffed. I would say, I'm not here to talk about the council in that sense, but certainly, with our charge and statewide responsibility, there's no doubt if we want to do it, let's do it right. I would say to you that we don't really have any choice but to do it, and I think we need to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Collins, for your testimony. Any questions? Is there anyone else from the working group that would like to, real briefly, we've got a bill coming up here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richmond Meister. I was a member of this group, basically just as typical Richmond Meister, very independent, asking questions. The bottom line for my own self is that there needs to be something. There needs to be some type of independence, type of authority or whatever. Whether or not it's created into what the ombudsman was 4 years ago when it was defunded or something in the future. One of the reasons why, because some of the research, and you got to remember, this is not totally funded with general dollars. It was basically, with what you could get for money and all that, and people, it was over a period of several months. And we scratched some of the surfaces, but some of the things that are here are things that may need to go into some things down the line. But at least I can say for my own self, there are issues of health care and there are issues of mental health in the system, whether it be local jails or whether it be in the institutions, the state institutions. So somehow, some way, those I think have to be independently addressed. And whether, I personally am in favor of a return to somewhat of an ombudsman, but again, if that's not going to happen, at least some type of independent someplace. And that was also part of the recommendation that we talked about. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just wanted to share that. And as we all know, with probably the announcement down the line later today, there may not be any money for a new initiative, but it's just something down the line. I think it's really, really important to keep in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Newmeister.
Thank you.
Anyone else have a brief comment? Okay. Please come forward. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Chairman Hamer. My name is Michael Unglin, members of the committee. I didn't know if there was going to be an opportunity for public testimony today, but I gambled that maybe it would happen, so that I could speak from a perspective that is difficult to speak from. It's where the rubber meets the road in the jail. Having been an inmate for all of one day, 2 hours, 49 minutes, I emphasize the detail there because jail personnel took the time to correct the 2 minutes at the beginning and the 1 minute at the end in terms of when I got in and when I got out. Very fastidious technical detail. In between, what jail personnel did was the exact opposite in terms of the experience that they put me into and what I suffered throughout that experience. I think it was Representative Walker who spoke about the difficulty of finding middle ground in the working group associated with many people who are representing people who have been inmates or families thereof versus the corrections oriented personnel from Department of Corrections or maybe Sheriff's Office, etc. I think that where the middle ground is the truth. And the responsibility of the state, the responsibility of an ombudsman, an independent entity, is to simply get to that truth. Yes, sometimes inmates cry wolf. Sometimes corrections personnel use the fact that people cry wolf to not take care of business. Sometimes corrections personnel write things that cover up important matters associated with the truth. I'll give you an example. I was in a restraint chair for over 4 hours. 3+ hours of that time, I was crying, begging, and pleading for relief from the agony created by the intentionally and then intentionally left extremely tight handcuffs and straps around my wrists. It was bad enough, the pain was bad enough that near the end I hallucinated from the pain. I was in that much trouble. 12 to 15 guards, deputies, leadership, nurses walked by my cell every 15 minutes I was supposed to be reported on. You will see in the log report, time after time, inmate okay, breathing noted, inmate okay, breathing noted, inmate okay, breathing noted. I can keep saying that about 20 or 30 more times. Simultaneous with every one of them hearing my screams for help. They have policies that say I'm supposed to be physically checked every hour, even if I'm not complaining. No one came in. And that, the very end, when I came out of there and I was asking for evidence, people in law enforcement and corrections, I think they're familiar with the concept of evidence. I wanted pictures. I wanted to talk to the police. I wanted to file a complaint. Okay? My log report from the leadership says that the inmate, upon removal, because I was demanding evidence of what happened, was making unreasonable demands and was uncooperative. If they ask you to drink gas and you say no, it'll go in the record as uncooperative behavior. That's where the ombudsman comes in, and that is to get to the truth. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Engel. I appreciate your testimony. If you can just keep this to like 1 minute or so, because we really got to go. Please come up.
Good morning, everyone. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Poupart. I live in the city of West St. Paul. I'm a former ombudsman for corrections from 1983 to 1991. I just wanted to inform you that I did offer some testimony during the working group, and I think there were a couple of points that I wanted to make that maybe were considered, but I didn't know if they are. I don't know if we had as much study about the appeal of the former ombudsman statute and why that took place. The other part of it is I want to make 2 points of an ombudsman that it must be independent, my experience. And my experience, by the way, goes back a long way from the dusty roads of an Indian reservation to the Ivy League halls of Harvard University, and in between 3 trips to the state training school at Red Wing and a felony conviction, a stay in Stillwater and a pardon from that conviction, and working 23 years in corrections, and I retired in 1994. So I have a bit of experience both inside the system and outside the system and in the middle. And I think this is one of the most critical parts of the criminal justice system that we need to focus on that is often ignored. I don't know how many of you know, but the corrections system is run on a paramilitary system where there's the wardens, the lieutenants, the captains, the sergeants, and the line staff. And there isn't much room to move in that structure, and that you're commonly, generally, responsible to the person above you and the person below you, or at least the position above you and below you. So that gives you not a whole lot of room to move. So the ombudsman was created out of a great deal of violence, intimidation, fear. In 1972, I was an observer of those times when murders occurred, when assaults occurred. And with the coming of the ombudsman, we reduced and eliminated those kinds of activities. It came in a great time of need. Now our system is much bigger. It is so much bigger. And yes, there are routines for complaints. There are places for those complaints to go. But what is really necessary to get those to work effectively is more of an independent observer to see that policy, procedure, and practice are followed with non-discriminatory behavior and attitude. So those things can be assured by an ombudsman. And my last point to you is that while it may not occur in this session, the ombudsman for correction, in light of the dismal forecast we're going into financially, it is something that we should keep on the table as something to do when we can do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Corpart, for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Milwaukee, you want to close up
real
quick here?
Yes, sure, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for the time that you allotted this morning, especially since we won't be taking action this year. Mr. Collins, triggered a thought that I'd like to leave with you. While we've spent so much time talking about the individuals that are currently incarcerated, I've been also contacted by individuals who have left our correctional system, one who actually testified at the public testimony. While these individuals are struggling to move on, they can't let go of someone that either some of the treatment that they felt while they were there and how that psychologically is staying with them, or some of the action that they still want to do as it relates to organizing inmates within the prison system. It's not something that these individuals, all of them, are just walking away saying the treatment was there and it was staying there. It's something that they're still bringing back into our communities. It's one of those things that part of the considerations of looking at how do you work with individuals that are reentering back into our society. We want to make sure that we not only have consequences for these individuals, that they also are treated like human beings and that they're given an opportunity to come back successfully into our society. And so again, members, I want to thank you for your time, and I look forward to figuring out some creative solutions in upcoming funding years.
Thank you, Representative Walker. May I have a motion from someone on the committee to approve the minutes of February 21st and February 26th? Representative Bigham moved.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
I was just looking at the minutes, and on the 26th, it said Paul Cole was excused, but he was also here. I was just wondering if that was...
Well, well, what really happened at the
here, I don't recall, but I think I was probably here, but I'll leave it to the discretion of you and the great recollection of Ms. Lacombe and Ms. Wyrum as to whether
the chair will move that we strike Representative Coles as being excused and insert him and just delete that he was excused, and that way he will be present February 26th. Any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment passes. Now we have a motion to approve the minutes of February 21st and 26th as amended. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? That motion prevails. Now we will go to Representative Simon, House File 1043. Representative Simon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be short because I know that you've just been through an important presentation. We don't have much time, and I have no testifiers. Member, House File 1043, if I may, Mr. Chair, just...
I'm going to I'll move the bill for you, and it's not my intent to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the supplement, in the public safety finance supplemental budget bill. if there is one.
If there is one. Thanks, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1043 is a bill that was heard and passed last year, almost a year ago now, I guess, by the Policy Committee, on which I sit. Obviously, I don't sit on this committee, but several members of this committee are on the bill, Representative Smith, Chairman Tamar, Representative Cornish, and others. And basically what the bill does is it models what other states have done with respect to registration of predatory offenders. Basically, the information that we require to be noted and registered is a way for us to ask, where are you? When we ask about primary and secondary residence, we're asking, where are you? We want to know where you are. When we ask about place of employment, we're asking, where are you? Similarly, when we ask about make and model a vehicle, we're basically asking, where are you? This is a way to modernize that question. Because oftentimes where people are in a virtual sense, not a physical sense, is where we don't want them to be. And so this just follows the model of Virginia and other states, and you're getting a handout now about what Virginia has already done, and other states have followed suit. But I think Virginia was the first and is the furthest along in the process, which enables states to monitor where people are in a virtual sense online by requiring that that information, too, be added to the list of what is required, and that's what this does. Mr. Chair, I have a delete everything amendment, the DE2 amendment, which members should have.
Okay, the chair will move the DE2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. We now have the bill in the form that you wanted, Representative Steiner.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, before I stand for any questions or comments, I'll just explain what in the DED amendment and why I thought it was necessary. I consulted after the bill already passed last year under the Policy Committee. I consulted with a number of people about making the bill better, and some folks, particularly from the Attorney General's office, suggested some language that would tighten and make better the definition of what exactly it was we were asking for. I liked it better than what I had originally, frankly. And if you look on page 2 of the bill, starting with line 2.9, in my opinion, the term online identifier, as suggested here, is a better definition than the one that I originally had. It's broader, and it really gets more precisely at what I think we're trying to do here. And then there's also the subsidiary definition of social networking website, which seems quite precise and useful to me. So I think that was an improvement on the bill as introduced, and so I agreed by way of this delete everything amendment to add it. The only other addition in the DE amendment would be on line 3.23, which is also something that in the intervening years since this bill was last heard, other states have done, which is not simply require that this information be part of the record and that predatory offenders register it, but also permit the BCA to provide a list of the identifiers, not names, not other personal identifying information, just the identifiers. So if it's, you know, Bow Wow 123 or something like that, that the person is using, that identifier would be shared, nothing more. And that can be used with the social networking websites, and that those websites can use the information to basically screen potential users of the networking site. So that's it. That's the only change since last year. And there is a fiscal note which you have in front of you. It's a one-time expenditure purportedly of $86,000. I personally have no way of knowing whether that's accurate, and while I'm not doubting the motivations or the compensations or the competence of anyone who put this together, it does seem high to me, and talking off the record with people who couldn't be here to testify, it seems high. The Department of Corrections, though, and others can maybe justify that, and that's the business that you're in, not me. So assuming that there is any money or there is a bill and that this is something desirable that you, the committee, want to do, then you can ask those questions. I do know, and I don't know if there's testimony here today, one of the reasons for the delay and why, as you're aware, Mr. Chair, we didn't do this last year is out of deference to law enforcement that had originally said, we love the idea, it's a great idea, but we want to see how the Adam Walsh Act fleshes out. Because under the Adam Walsh Act, assuming that we ultimately adopt it, there will have to be some registration changes anyway, and if we have to change the database anyway, why not just do it all in one fell swoop? And that made sense to me, even though this might be something that the committee and the body wants to do. why put law enforcement through two changes of the database and two sets of mailings and all the rest. But what I've come to understand, and all of you may know better than I, is that full implementation of the Adam Walsh Act may be delayed longer than we had originally thought, or at least that I had been led to believe it would a year ago. I thought maybe this was a matter of several months or a year or so. Now I'm hearing that full implementation of Adam Walsh might not happen, for example, until 2011. So it's really up to you, and as members of the committee, to decide whether, first, you have a comfort level with the $86,000 fiscal note. Second, of course, if we have any money to spend on it. But assuming, just for the sake of argument, that you decide to do that, whether you want to do it now or whether you want to wait for implementation of the Adam Walsh Act. If you think it's a good enough policy to do now and not wait, for example, till 2011, that's up to you, obviously. If you'd rather wait, that's up to you as well. But I thought it important to put this new language on it, place it before you, and then depending on multiple factors, obviously you'll do with it what you will. But I'll be open for questions or comments.
We have questions, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, I think this is kind of common sense, but just a question about some of the information you passed out. You passed out three articles from Virginia. The first is about the Attorney General proposing legislation. The second is the Attorney General saying that he plans to push a said proposal. And the third being that he will push for legislation. But nowhere is there any information on whether or not a law has actually passed in Virginia. So my question, does Virginia have said law in the books? And if so, do they have data which shows that they have captured predatory offenders since the implementation of the law and due to the implementation of the law?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Biskin. The answer to the first question, I believe, is yes. I think they've come to an agreement, in fact, just recently. I didn't have the article here for you, with a number of the social networking sites. The answer to the second question, as far as I know, is no. I've not seen any data or heard of any data about how they're doing and whether they've actually netted anyone trying to do something they're not supposed to do. So I don't know the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, if there is a supplemental bill, I would be inclined to push for this being part of it, but in helping make that push to know the answer to those two questions in the definitive would be helpful. Thank you.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, in your discussions with the department, looking at the fiscal note, and I guess a couple questions I have, because like Representative Biskins, I think this makes sense, and I'm questioning, I guess, the size of the fiscal note as well, Representative Simon. Reading the assumptions in the fiscal note, I understand there's an annual verification letter process. Is that all done by snail mail, and is there any kind of online or electronic system where we can get verification from individuals? They can go on and click that this is where they're still at. They can lie online just as easily as they could lie through snail mail. So I'm curious if this is all done done the old-fashioned way, or if there's an online way to do that, and if that might be a way we could save some costs here.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Polk. I don't know the answer to that, actually, and I think we would all be well served by maybe hearing testimony from those on the front lines of this. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, would that be possible?
Representative Polk.
There's somebody from DPS, I think, who's available.
Very good. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Anne Marie O'Neill from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I'm the Senior State Program Administrator responsible for the Predatory Offender Registration Unit. In answer to your question, currently everything is coming in snail mail. We do not have any electronic information coming in from the registrants. Part of the reason for that is we need the physical signature before we can update any of the information in the Predatory Offender database. So we are sending those annual verification letters out. That's also a means to make sure that they are living at the address that they are reporting to us. So we send it via mail, and then we make sure that it comes back.
Mr. Chairman, that's obviously a much bigger issue than this bill, and I think it's something that we ought to be thinking about, not just in the public safety area, but we're so woefully behind the times with technology across state government, it's almost embarrassing. But that's a much broader discussion for another day. And I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't catch your name.
Anne-Marie O'Neill.
Ms. O'Neill, Mr. Chairman, the number here, the programming cost is $110 an hour. That equates to an annual salary of about $200,000 a year. Is that what we're paying our programmers at DCA or I'm not sure if it's the Department of Administration that does the programming or who does it, but that seems like a fairly large sum of money, except for maybe attorneys. I'm not sure that we're paying anybody else here in the state of Minnesota much more than that.
Ms. O'Neill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, members of the committee, yes, we are paying a consultant for the programming of the POR database. That consultant is housed physically at the BCA, but is not a state employee.
Mr. Chairman, again, I think that's probably a bigger issue, maybe another issue for another day, but I would sure think we could find some 24-year-old kid out of college who probably knows more than or knows as much as some other people and pay him $100,000 a year instead of $200,000 a year. But Mr. Chair, I guess I'll leave this for now. We should figure out a way to do this, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure that we can have some discussions about how much whether we should make the department do this or whether we should fund the department to do this.
I don't think we should let this go. I think that you make good points here, Representative Coles, and we should follow up on this. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I concur. I think this is much needed policy. How do we enforce it?
Simon.
That's a great question, Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland. That's a good question. And to be candid, I think that the benefit in a law like this is less in the enforcement than in the sort of overall risk or specter out there that if the person doesn't register and is in fact using an online identifier, that there's a risk for that offender. I think you're right. In a perfect world, we'd have sort of cyber police out there watching where people are going on the internet and all the rest, but you raise a very good question, which is why, to be candid, I think the benefits are other than those, probably. Yeah.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually wanted to comment about that. MySpace.com actually does produce the names of the offenders who are currently using MySpace, and frankly, they're not smart enough to use their own name, even when they are prohibited from using it. And so that is currently happening. MySpace.com provides us with the names of the offenders that are not supposed to be online, and then they also jump the page. And so by requiring them to also list their identifier, that will enable us to find out the people that aren't using their real name that happen to be the offenders that are supposed to be offline, only making the program that is already working much more effective.
All right, is there any other questions? Representative Simon, do you have any closing comments? Mr. Carter just informed me that between March of last year to today, that the fiscal note has now gone up to $94,000 a year.
What a surprise, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I could add two things for the committee's benefit. One, yes, the fiscal note will be a little bit higher this year because there has been salary increases since last year's fiscal note. And the other thing that I wanted to just touch on briefly was the Adam Walsh Act. And it is true that collecting email and internet identifiers is part of the Adam Walsh federal requirements. And it's something that certainly we'll be discussing in the future. What happened, and kind of why I think this issue got tabled last year, was that we are waiting for the final guidelines to come from the federal government. And the proposed guidelines came out in May of 2007. There was a comment period that ended in August of 2007, and we are still waiting for those final guidelines to come out. And it's difficult to go forward with legislation until we know what those final guidelines are. And I think they had over 885 pages of comments that are listed on the Smart Office's website. many of those comments asking for significant changes to the proposed guidelines, and I think the states are very anxious, and my counterparts across the country are very anxious to get those final guidelines, but they simply have not been made available to us by the SMART office.
Nicole.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. O'Neill, did the cost of the contract for the consultants who's doing the programming for the for this increase as well?
Mr. Chair, no, it was not the contract person. It is the cost of the office administrative specialist that has gone up. So the people that actually be collecting and doing the data entry of this information.
Mr. Chairman, just so nobody's confused, I continue to be an advocate of privatization where it makes sense. I'm not sure that that this is an area where it makes fiscal sense. If we can figure out a way to do something as effectively and at less cost by utilizing, you know, partnering with the private sector, I'm all for it. But if it's being done, if it's not efficient and effective, I think there's maybe another way to do it.
Very good. Any other questions? Mr. Simon, anything else?
Nothing
further. Very good. The chair will lay House File 1043 on the, as amended, on the table. Thank you, Representative Simon. Thank you, members. We're adjourned.